Welcome. As the complex cultural and historical and religious heritage of biblical Israel evolved into the even more complex heritage of rabbinic Judaism in the Greco-Roman period, Judaism could be understood as something of an inverted pyramid, with the Bible standing at the bottom, at the bottom, thin, growing wider as it went to the top. As the complex combination of biblical Israel and rabbinic Judaism entered the Middle Ages, they confronted something brand new. They confronted a new historical, social, socio-political situation as a minority culture living in the majority culture of two monotheistic religions that had very close intimate relationships with Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Living as a minority in these host cultures was something brand new from a political and social point of view. Intellectually and religiously, the heritage of rabbinic Judaism confronted a parallel innovation in religious life. Ideas that had been relatively unknown in the biblical period and in the rabbinic period confronted Jews living in their new circumstances of the Middle Ages in the form of a conflict between the values of the physical world, materiality, things as they seem to be, and the higher values of spirit or inwardness. The job of medieval Jewish intellectuals and mystics and pietists was to transform Judaism in alignment with the new set of ideals that made spirit preeminent over body. They reinterpreted the entire corpus of Jewish literature, practice, and life to bring it into alignment with the new ideals of medieval civilization that made spirit, inwardness, interiority the goals to which we should all aspire. We've seen some hints of these various attempts at interiority. The philosophic, scientific tradition decided that the way to go was to find interiority in rationality and in the scientific investigation of the laws that made nature look so regular. Rabbinic Judaism had taught Jews that the entire universe was one interlocked, uniform system known as the Kingdom of God, with the same set of powers and benevolent wisdom running all things. The philosophers decided that they would turn to scientific, philosophic, rational inquiry in order to better understand what rabbinic Judaism had taught about the uniformity of the entire world, of the kingdom of the universe. They relied heavily on the scientific and philosophic tradition of ancient Greece, studying Aristotle with a great deal of conscientious care, hoping to find clarification for how God's universe was run in the light of Aristotelian philosophy and science. That was the philosopher's way of finding interiority, by human intellect applying itself to the secrets of the universe around them. The German Hasidim took another path toward interiority, not by giving intellect preeminence, but by giving preeminence to the search for interiority by developing techniques for observing what was going on beneath the surface of things, what was going on beneath the surface of the religious revelations that prophets and mystics had seen, those gorgeous, magnificent, resplendent images of God and angels that had been reported. What were they but containers for a more deep, more innermost divine spiritual essence, which they were able to perceive? That same insight or technique for gaining insight was applied by the German Hasidim, not with intellectual philosophic tools, but with these new techniques for erasing or effacing the surface meaning of things. And what they did with the revelations of God by finding spirit within it, they did to the text of the Bible, they did to the phenomena of nature, they did to everything around them, piercing through the surface to get down to the underlying structure that unified all things, the spiritual presence of that immanent God whose spirit made all things be. This was not the way of the philosophers that used intellect to understand the laws of regularity that govern the universe, but a mystical set of techniques for insight, and we examined some of those in earlier lectures. The German pietists turned their attention to the search for interiority in the world as extroverted mystics. Abulafia took those same techniques and turned them not against the text of the Bible and not against the world of nature and not against anything else, but he turned those techniques for reforming consciousness on himself. And we examined some of those techniques and the goal which Abulafia hoped to attain in changing the way his mind worked, in changing the way perception operated, in giving preeminence to the absolute identity between the human mind and the divine. That was his version of the search for interiority. Inspired by philosophy, in particular Maimonides, but far from the philosophic study of the rules of nature. We also began to look at a third form of interiority, which began to emerge in texts that appeared at the end of the 12th century and in the 13th century in southern France, known as Provence, and in Spain, where the search for interiority was unlike that of the German Hasidim, which looked for it in the texts of the Bible or behind the text of the Bible and in nature, and unlike that of Abulafia, which looked to the structures, deep structures of human consciousness, but turned to the search for interiority and understanding God's own personality. As Abulafia delved deeper and deeper and deeper into the mechanics and processes of his own thinking, the other Jewish mystics in the Middle Ages turned their attention to understanding the depths of God's living being. And that's what we've been calling theosophy. This, too, was not the way of the philosophers that used intellect and rationality to understand the underlying order and regularity of the universe. Quite to the contrary, it seems that the mystics who delved into the inner depths of God's being, understanding all things to be symbolic expressions of deep, deep processes within the divine, had nothing to do with intellect. They claimed that their discoveries were based on something other than the efforts of the human mind. It was a wisdom that was passed down from master to teacher, a Kabbalah, a tradition, and it was something that couldn't be figured out with the unaided human mind. Nachmanides, Moses ben Nachman, the mystic and leader of Spanish Jewry in the 13th century, gives us a good insight into the antagonism which the delvers into the depths of God's being felt toward the philosophic attempt to use intellect to understand the world. In the introduction to his commentary to the Bible, Nachmanides, the one who taught us that the Bible speaks about low things, this world, but alludes always to the depths of God's being, says this as a warning to those who would study his commentary to the Bible, which would hint to people that the Bible is really a book all about God, not only about the ordinary world, but a book in which God reveals himself, the process by which God comes into full being. And this is what Nachmanides, Moses ben Nachman, wrote in that introduction, a warning. Those of you who peruse this book, I beg you, I urge you not to indulge in speculative opinions, nor should you entertain any thoughts concerning any of the allusions to the secrets of the Torah which I shall write. Nachmanides tells us that he will not be explicit in spelling out what these mysteries are, and he calls them the secrets of the Torah, by which he meant the secrets of God's inner being. And as for those secrets of God's inner being, which he will not write about in detail, but merely allude to, intellect and human reason can have no purchase at all, no entry into the world of God's being through unaided human intellect. For I faithfully inform him that reads this book, Nachmanides continued, that nothing will be apprehended and nothing at all be known by any act of intellect or reasoning unless it come by means of an oral communication from one wise traditionalist, a mikubal, a kabbalist, to an understanding traditional, to another understanding traditionalist or kabbalist. This was to be an oral transmission from master to teacher. Speculation and opinionating is foolishness. Free thinking causes great harm and precludes any benefit. Let not anybody be misled by falsehood, for only evil shall come his way because of speculation and opinion making, since speaking falsely about God permits no atonement. That's the antagonism of the Theosophical Kabbalists to those in the Jewish community who thought that by unaided human intellect and by the study of Greek sciences and philosophy, the secrets of the universe would be understood, since for them the secrets of the universe were only available to those who were belonged to the chain of transmission of the secrets of the Torah. The secrets of the Torah being God's inner life. In an earlier lecture, we read some passages from the Bahir, the Book of Dazzlement, that had appeared at the end of the 12th century, which introduced us to the basic symbolic terminology or mindset that Theosophical Kabbalists use. The entire Torah is one long name of God. God has many, many powers, sfirot, potencies, as if they were terminals on a battery from which God's energy emanated forth to create this world. God's names are East and West. God's names are Prince and Princess, Father's House, Treasure, Brain, Spine. Take a name from whatever domain one wants, and one can read it as an allusion to a secret within God's own being. The search for interiority within God, then, is what this lecture will try to delve into slightly more, with some more detail. From the book of the Bahir, from the book of the Dazzlement, which appeared at the end of the 12th century, to the classic of Jewish mysticism, which appeared in Spain at the end of the 13th century, about in 1285, the bulk of it being written by a man called Moses de Leon, who claimed that he himself didn't write this, but that it was an ancient rabbinic book, a set of Midrashim, commentaries on the Bible. There were 100 years of very intense, active speculation, transmission of secrets, and development of the ideas surrounding God's inner life. Once it was pointed out to people that the entire Bible is one long self-disclosure of God's inner dynamics, then it was merely a question of taking that point of view and reading the Bible to extract its mysteries. The Bible became the repository par excellence for insight into the secrets of God's being. Not reason, not intellect, not philosophy, not the books of the Gentiles, but the Bible itself, the Jewish book par excellence, became the repository of secrets, a roadmap, as it were, to the inner life of God. And so, referring back to one of the early questions I raised, what is Jewish about Jewish mysticism? One obvious answer is that Jewish mysticism is so intimately connected to the reading of the Bible, to the Hebrew Bible, to the Tanakh, as the Jews call it, or the Old Testament, as it's known in other communities, that the intimate relationship between reading the Jewish Bible and the secrets of Jewish mysticism is so intimate that one is inconceivable without the other. Jewish mysticism is Jewish to the extent that it relies on the imaginative, creative reading of the Bible, seeing it as ordinary language about extraordinary things, the extraordinary things being the secrets of God's being. The book, which no longer dealt with mere allusions, the book which made all of this quite explicit at great length, unlike Nachmanides, who wrote only hints in his commentary to the Bible, the book which spelled it all out, a library of mystical midrash on the Bible, standing on at least 100 years of very intense development in Spain and Provence, is the book Zohar, the Book of Splendor, written by Moses de Leon. The Zohar is the classic, the most important repository of all of the secrets of the Theosophical tradition in Kabbalah. Some passages from it, I think, will make clear how the Zohar rests itself on the earlier traditions and pushes the ideas even further. Let's begin with its attitude toward the Torah, the Bible, the object, the book, the scroll which is read in the synagogue, or the book which is studied in the study house, in the Beit HaMidrash. The Torah as an artifact in the world, as a book, as the book governing Jewish life. The Zohar has a passage in which the Torah is likened unto a beautiful and stately maiden who is isolated in a chamber in a tower of a palace somewhere. This maiden, who is likened unto the Torah, secluded in her palace, has a lover. And the only one who knows that this woman, beautiful woman, has a lover is the woman herself. The lover is so infatuated with this maiden, the Torah, that he passes by her gate unceasingly and turns his eyes in all directions to catch the merest glimpse at her. The maiden in her tower, very chivalric image, knows that her lover is going about underneath the window of her palace room searching for her. And so what does she do, this maiden, secluded in her tower? She opens up a small window, a small door in her secret chamber, and for a minute flashes her face to the lover who's in search of her, and then quickly withdraws her face from the window and shuts it behind her. The only one to have noticed that the maiden revealed herself is the lover. No one else seems to see it. But he comes to the conclusion, because of this gesture that she had made, that it was out of her love for him that she revealed herself, just as it was out of his love that he perpetually searched for her. And so after this quick glimpse at his beautiful maiden in the secluded room, he dedicates his heart and soul and everything within him to her. The Zohar then continues, making explicit what should have been obvious. The Torah, who is the maiden, she works in exactly the same way. Her real meaning is secret and hidden and veiled behind walls and windows. She knows that people are searching about for her meaning, but her meaning is not obvious on the surface. So what does the Torah do? Like the maiden, she quickly shows her face to her lover, sending him a signal of her love, and then retreats quickly to her hiding place. The one who searches the Torah for secrets takes this gesture, this opening hint of what her true identity is, and dedicates himself, being drawn to her all the more and more. It's a very romantic medieval tale of the knight who falls in love with a beautiful maiden and who have secret messages between one another. To the outside world, the love is not apparent. The maiden does not make herself known to everyone. Few are in possession of the true meaning of the Bible. Few within the Jewish community, and certainly even fewer outside of the Jewish community. But within the Jewish community, the few who see the Torah sending her messages of love are drawn to her all of the more. And as he comes more and more close to her, she reveals more and more of herself, more and more of herself, with fewer barriers between her and her lover. First, she speaks to him behind a filmy veil of mesh, a curtain, and she speaks to him in riddles and allegories. And finally, when he has nearly come to terms with her, she stands face to face and holds conversation with him concerning all of her secret mysteries and all of the secret ways which have been hidden in her heart from immemorial time. And when she reveals himself finally fully to him after stages of progressive revelation, he finally sees all of the signs of love and understands the secrets of the Torah, which are the secrets of God's inner being. That is what the Torah as an artifact is, a maiden who in progressive revelations makes herself more and more known, obscure in the beginning, more obvious at the end. And all of this summed up in the relationship of very romantic, chivalric love. That's the Torah as an artifact, the repository, which needs to be examined for its secrets. The Torah, however, in the theosophic tradition is not merely an artifact. It, too, is a symbol. It is an earthly expression of something deep and divine. The Torah is a book, a scroll, but it is also the name of God, or a name of one of those potencies within God's own being. Torah is a symbol, a name for something within God, not just an artifact, but something deep within the being of God's own existence. And so the Torah is worth studying, because the more we understand the Torah, the more we come to understand God. And the more we come to understand God, the more we come to understand how all of reality is a mirror reflecting God's own inner being. Another passage in the Zohar makes this, I think, very clear in a very dramatic, audacious way. The Zohar begins with a criticism of those who read the Bible as literature. Woe unto those who only think of the Torah as a book presenting stories and everyday matters, ordinary language about ordinary things, stories about the creation of the physical heaven and earth, stories about the historical experience of the Jewish people and their wanderings in the desert after the exile, nice stories about the kings of Israel, horrible stories about the catastrophes that befell the people. If that's all you think the Bible is, nice stories and obvious laws, then you've missed the whole point. If you think that it's a special book, a book given by God about ordinary things, you've missed the point. Woe unto you if that's how you read the Bible so literally. Because if that's all the Bible were, an obvious, everyday, extraordinary book about extraordinary things, lovely poetry, interesting laws, interesting imagery, well, says the author of the Zohar, well, we could probably write a better book than that. If the Bible is merely literature, it's not all that great. You and I probably could sit down and write an even better one. And in fact, we have a suspicion that the rulers of the universe, kingdoms and other places, have books which, as literature, are even better than the Bible. But the Bible is not an ordinary book, the Zohar continues. The Torah, in all of its words, conveys mysteries of the upper world and conveys sublime secrets. And these are the secrets of God's inner being and the way God's inner being is mirrored and recapitulated throughout reality. The Zohar continues, "See how precisely balanced are the upper and the lower worlds." And by upper world, he means the upper inner world of God's being, the world of the Sefirot. And by the lower world, he means everything other than God, as if the soul were the upper world of the human being and the body were the lower world of the human being. God is the soul of the universe, in the language of upper really meaning inner, and the lower world is the body, its structures, its organs, and its functions. Whatever exists down here in this balanced system exists also within God's inner being. And it was the Torah which created that world, the inner and the outer. Therefore, the Torah must be studied because it's not merely an ordinary book, but it is the book that holds the secret of this balanced mirror relationship between the upper world and the lower world, and it is itself the instrument by which those worlds came into being. So the Zohar develops a parable, an analogy. The Torah in its many layers, remember the maiden, she reveals herself in stages. The Torah is like the human being. If we want to understand the mysteries of the Torah, and from there to understand the mysteries of God, let's look at something very ordinary. A human being, for example. There are layers and layers and layers to the human being. The outermost, most obvious layer, the one that we all perceive easily through sensation, are the clothes, the garments that people wear. That's the most external, literal level of the human being. But who would be foolish enough to think that the clothes are the person? The clothes are merely an adornment or a protection for something within the clothes which are more important, and that's the body. Clothes are not what define the human being. The level beneath that is the human body. And then, of course, the body is not the last word either, because woe unto those who think that once you've gotten behind the clothes and perceive the body, you've got the true human being. No, because as the clothes are to the body is to something even more innermost in the human being, the soul. That's level number three, the soul. And if you think that you finally have reached the end by coming to the human soul, you're mistaken there too, because the pattern of covering externality and internality continues all the way down through the system. The soul too is merely an outermost covering to something deeper. The soul has levels to it too. The soul has a soul itself, if you will. We understood some of this from Abraham Abulafia's investigation of medieval philosophy. Remember that the soul had several operations. There was sensation and imagination and intellect. And so once you get to the level of the inner life of the human being, you see that there's layer upon layer of spiritual structure and operations to be investigated. One can almost go on infinitely from the outside clothes worn by a body to the body, from the body to the soul. And once one gets into the soul through introspection, discovering deeper and deeper and deeper layers of the human interior personality. Well, if that's true of the human being, then how much more so must be true, concludes the Zohar, about the Bible. It too has layers and layers and layers of meaning, external literal meaning, a level within that which is more sublime and more abstract and more spiritual, the body of the Torah, its basic principles. The body of the Torah, like the human being, has a soul, an inner spiritual essence. And once one has reached the inner spiritual essence of the Bible, there are more and more layers to descend, to penetrate, so to speak, descending into the garden of nuts, going deeper and deeper and deeper into the world of the divinity. That's true of the Torah. And if, therefore, it's true of the human being, and it's true of the Torah, then how much more so must it be true about God himself, or itself, that God is not a simple, obvious thing, but that there are layers and layers and layers and depths within depths of God's being, an outermost and an innermost. And it's the mystical journey of insight through the various layers of God's being that one discovers what the structure of the inner world is. The Zohar's own language, slightly paraphrased. See now how this is the way it is in the upper world, with garment, body, soul, and soul within soul. The outer garments are the heavens and all of the things therein. The body of God is called symbolically the community of Israel, and it is the recipient of the soul, the soul being the name of a deeper layer within God, which the Zohar in this passage calls the glory of Israel. And this glory of Israel, layer within God's own inner being, itself becomes the receptacle for a soul within that. And that soul within the soul is the soul of the ancient Holy One. And the Zohar concludes, all these are conjoined, one within the other. Beginning from the innermost center and working itself out almost as if it were on the analogy of an onion with its layers of peels, one layer after the other, one covering the one beneath it, the one covering that one in turn becoming the thing covered by the one outside of it. And all of these are conjoined in one unified, tight system. From the innermost being of God, almost in a continuous flow of divine energy, from the inner to the outer, one conjoined system, layer upon layer, with everything on the outside having its counterpart on the inside, and everything on the inside having its counterpart on the outside. It doesn't make any difference what you look at. They all reveal the same pattern, since everything is conjoined, one within the other. So the Zohar will have passages saying, consider the flame. Just observe a candle. The candle, too, is structured layer upon layer. There's the body, the material, the waxy substance of the candle. There's the wick. And if you look at the wick as it burns, you see not one undifferentiated flame, but you see layers and layers and layers of flame with different color. Closest to the wick, it's an invisible white flame, the hottest part. Above that is a crown of yellow flame, and on top of that is blue and red. And if you consider and contemplate that structure of the waxy body candle and the wick and the stages and differentiations of the flame, one has a clue to what the Torah is like too. It has its external physical. It too has its layers and layers of color with difference in intensity and difference in heat. A candle is to the human being what the human being is to the Torah as an artifact, a book filled with layer and layers of meaning. And the book and the candle and the human being or the nut or whatever else it is that you might want to contemplate or consider are all analogs recapitulating the secrets of God's inner life. God, too, is layer upon layer, multi-differentiated. In the tradition, there are 10 main layers, but I wouldn't take that too literally. It's a symbolic way of saying that there is a structure and organization, but the infinity of processes and combinations is beyond the human intellect's ability to understand. And so the Zohar concludes this passage. Woe unto the sinners who look upon the Torah, the artifact, as simply tales pertaining to things of this world, seeing thus only the outer garments. The literalists and the fundamentalists who think that the meaning of the Bible resides on its surface are sinners indeed. But the righteous, the truly religious person, whose gaze penetrates to the very soul and inwardness of the Torah, happy are they. And why is this so, that the Torah only keeps its secrets deep down within itself, the way the maiden must secrete and hide herself behind the tower? The Zohar can find examples and proofs for its arguments everywhere, and so it uses a very homely analogy of wine in a jar. Why did the inner spiritual essence of God need to embody itself in the container of the physical universe? Why does the human soul need to reside in a body? Why must fire depend on the physicality of a candle to burn? And the answer of the Zohar is the same on all levels. Just as wine must be kept in a jar to keep, so the Torah must be contained in an outer garment. That garment is made up of tales and stories, but we are bound to penetrate beyond. If you have wine and don't have a container with a plug to store it up, it'll evaporate or turn sour. The implication being that the very process of life is that God too needs a container, which is the universe, which audaciously suggests that without the physical universe and without the layers of God's own being, in some sense, symbolically, poetically, in a way that the mind is not quite able to understand, although the mind generates the idea, God would be spoiled were it not for the entire complex structure of things within God which emanate out into this world. Again and again and again, one is struck by the audacity of the Zohar's way of thinking of God's relationship to the world. So if we were to ask, what is the meaning of the verse in Ecclesiastes, Kol hanachalim holchim el hayam, v'hayam einenu malei, all of the rivers lead into the ocean, but the ocean is never full. We can read that as ordinary language about ordinary things, about rivers on the planet Earth leading into some body of water, continuously without ever overflowing. Or we can read it as ordinary language about extraordinary things and read it in the way that the Zohar does and say that the references here are all references to God's inner being. These layers, these containers, these envelopes, these bodies and souls, connected by channels, all flow into the same place, into the sea. Constant, dynamic life. All of the channels, all of the rivers flow into the sea. But the sea itself, that place in God where all the powers coalesce, v'hayam einenu malei, but that sea is never full. A very paradoxical way of putting the idea that God's all-inclusiveness, it's all interconnectivity, it's all of God being interconnected with all the other parts of God, flow together dynamically, but never exhaust the system. The Zohar learns its metaphors and takes its ideas from wherever it can. It was the German Chassidim who taught them that, in some sense, God's existence is like one candle. One candle can ignite all of the candles in the world and in no way be diminished by igniting all of the other light. To give light as a candle doesn't take anything away from one's own candle. And in that sense, God is the candle igniting the wicks of everything that exists without thereby being exhausted. All of the rivers flow to the sea, but the sea is not full. And so the Zohar, unlike the other systems that we've seen, doesn't interest itself in deconstructing the Bible by reading it as a code. It reads it as one long symbolic structure, giving us the secrets to God's inner world and thereby also giving us the secrets of the world around us. I used before the analogy of Abbott and Costello about what all of these names refer to. And these names refer to these aspects of God, the ten sefirot, which are related to each other in all of the infinite number of ways in which things go. Who is on first, from a Kabbalistic point of view, would certainly be one of the names of God, who. What's on second would also be another of the names of God. God's name would be what, and that would be God as the second baseman, whatever that very strange symbolism might suggest. One more passage from the Zohar to sum this up. From our old friend, the Garden of Nuts. We already learned from the German Chassidim that the nut was understood as a symbol for divine things. It has two halves, four compartments, lines through the middle, and each one of these compartments corresponds to something in the divine world of the chariot. But for the Zohar, we're not interested in the chariot. We're interested in the very structure of God, and in the same breath, in the structure of all of reality. So the Zohar has this passage interpreting midrashically, mystically, the descent into the Garden of Nuts. Well, King Solomon apparently picked up a nut and looked at it and discovered the secrets of God and the universe in its structure. The Zohar continues, "The Holy One, blessed be He, God, saw that it was necessary to structure the world in the way that nuts are structured, with the soft inner core, the meat, the sweet meat of the nut, protected and concealed inside, with layer upon layer of protective shell and structure to keep the soft innerness of the nut meat protected and fresh. That's exactly the way the entire universe and God is structured too, like a nut. All things, so to speak, have an interior sweet meat and an external structure to protect it. The whole world, the Zohar concludes, the whole world, the lower world in which we live and the upper world of God or the inner world of God's being is structured exactly the same. The whole world, upper and lower, is organized on this principle. From the very primary mystic center, the depths of God's inner being, to the outermost realm of the physical universe, All things are coverings, one to the other, brain within brain, soul within soul, spirit inside of spirit, shell within shell. In the very center of the universe, which is understood as a knot, is a point which is so subtle and so spiritual, the depths of depths, that it's not visible at all, in the way that the light surrounding a wick is not really visible. As one moves away from the inner center, things become more differentiated, more colored, more interactive, more layered, more revealed, in the way that maiden did at the tower, who began hidden behind a thick wall in a tower of a palace, and then who revealed herself slowly but surely, first behind a veil, and then face to face. The entire universe is made that way. The innermost secret point of God's being has a palace around it, another symbolic name for one of the structures within God's being. And from this palace, there is an emanation. More and more of God pours forth, creating new structures, new garments, new bodies. From then outward, there is extension upon extension, each layer becoming a garment to the one beneath it, one thing being a membrane to the brain within it. Though membrane first, each extension becomes brain to the next extension, as if the entire universe were a set of Chinese boxes, one containing another, infinitely getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The mystic being the one who knows how to open the first box, not be surprised to find another box nestled in there, know enough to open the second box to find a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, a seventh, ad infinitum, until the very depths of God's being are reached. That's the way things are within God's own self unfolding, and that's the way the process goes on in our world too, the Zohar concludes. Likewise does the process go on down here. And after this basic design of the universe, man in the world combines organs with protective sheaths covering them, spirit, soul protected by the shield of the body. And why is the universe structured this way, from the innermost realm of God to the outermost realm of reality? The Zohar is extraordinarily optimistic. This is all for the more perfect ordering of the world. And the Zohar concludes enigmatically, the way all mystical passages need to conclude, enigmatically, inviting intellect to understand it, but defying complete, total understanding. Since the entire universe was structured that way for the more perfect ordering of the whole, we understand now why, when the moon was conjoined with the sun, the moon was luminous. But when she went apart from the sun and was given governance of her own hosts at night, her status and her light were reduced, and shell after shell was fashioned for investing the brain, habilitating it, putting a garment on it. And all was for its good. This is the best of all possible worlds, according to the Zohar. And by worlds, it means not only the lower one in which we live, but the world from which all of this derives, the inner world of God's being. This external world is an index to the inner psychological, psychic realm of God's being. And as a psychotherapist would read all of human behavior, as an indicator, an index to processes, conflicts, and the resolutions of conflicts within the human soul, so too does the mystic read the entire Bible as a set, the entire Bible and the entire universe, as a set of symptoms, indicators, barometers, pointing to the mysteries of the inner world of God, because that's what the Theosophical Kabbalist wants to do, to descend unto the very depths and understand the inner workings of the divine structure. Thank you.